Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture. One of the key central claims of David Hume's philosophy, considered as a whole, takes place in the inquiry concerning human understanding, specifically in section 5, which is entitled Skeptical Solution of These Doubts. The doubts are those raised earlier in section 4. And David Hume is often talked about as being a skeptical philosopher, but he's the kind of skeptic that thinks that we don't have an overall way of approaching things in the world or even in the life of the mind as skeptics who demand evidence for every single thing and say, well, we can't really know anything. He's not a dogmatic skeptic. He's a skeptic who thinks that skepticism itself will reveal to us at least some ways of getting by. And this applies in particular to what we can call practical philosophy, dealing with action, dealing with the world, dealing with what we're deciding to do or not to do, our prioritizations, our choices, right? But it also deals with what he calls speculative philosophy as well. And he's delving in that section into how does cause and effect really work if it's not based on any sort of experience of the causal connection between what we think to be cause and effect, why is it that we buy into it? And if we don't have an answer for this, then it seems like all of our reasonings concerning what he calls matters of fact or real existence, the relation between empirical things in the world, like a chalkboard and my knuckle and the sound that it makes and the solidity that it has, all of those seem to become questionable. They get called into doubt. And Hume says, as a matter of fact, that's not what happens with us. We don't doubt about all these things, so it's kind of weird what's actually going on there. And he's asking us, well, what principle allows us to reason beyond the experiences that we're having? He tells us that we don't have to fear that philosophy, while it endeavors to limit our inquiries to common life, will ever undermine the reasonings of common life and carry its doubts so far as to destroy all action as well as speculation. Nature will always maintain her rights and prevail in the end over any abstract reasoning whatsoever. What nature here, he means something like an instinct within us. But it's not actually going to turn out to be purely instinctual. There's some input coming in, and we process it, and we come up with this principle. So he says that though we should conclude that in all reasonings from experience, there is a step taken by the mind which is not supported by any argument or process of the understanding, meaning we're always kind of taking a leap of faith to some degree in, the things that we're reasoning about in the world or even within ourselves. He uses the passions as examples, although we might think about the passions of other people as well. So he says, there is such a step which is not supported. There is no danger that these reasonings on which almost all knowledge depends will ever be affected by such a discovery. So two other key things there, right? Almost all of our knowledge depends on this, on taking these leaps, but there's no danger. Well, why? What is the principle that allows us to do that? And he says, let's consider two people before we have the big reveal, right? So one person is very bright. He says they're endowed with the strongest faculties of reason and reflection. They have no cognitive difficulties at all. They can reason things out, sort of like a computer that's got a, amazing processor, but it doesn't yet have any input. So he says, imagine a person like this to be brought on a sudden into the world. What would they observe? What would they experience? He says, it would just be a continual succession of objects and one event following another. Okay, so that's like what we experience. But there's a vital difference. He would not be able to discover anything further. He would not at first, by any reasoning, be able to reach the idea of cause and effect. Why not? The particular powers by which all natural operations are performed never appear to the senses, so he can't get it through the senses, nor is it reasonable to conclude merely because one event in one instance precedes another that therefore one is the cause, the other the effect. The conjunction may be arbitrary and casual. So this person is thrust forth into the world that we know and experience, and they're not able to make sense of it. They're not able to see it in the way that we almost automatically do. Why? Because they're lacking something. Now consider the case of another person. He says, suppose again that this person has acquired more experience. He's lived so long in the world to have observed similar objects or events to be constantly conjoined together. What is the consequence of this experience? He immediately infers the existence of one object from the appearance of the other. Yet, he has not, by all his experience, acquired any idea or knowledge of the secret power by which one object produces the other. Nor is it by any process of reasoning he's engaged to draw this inference. But he does find himself determined to draw it. Even though he's convinced his understanding has no part in the operation, he would nevertheless continue in the same course of thinking. This is kind of puzzling, isn't it? Right? You've got a person who didn't have any experience, now he's got some, and without like having to reason it out and say to himself, oh, you know, I've noticed that in many cases, this thing here happens and then this thing happens, I should reason that there's a high probability that this will produce this. There's nothing like that going on. If there is a reasoning process, it's largely implicit or unconscious. So what's actually happening here? Hume says, we've got a principle that's going on. And this principle determines him to form this conclusion. What is this principle? He says it's custom or habit. He prefers the word custom. I think in the present, we would prefer the term habit because we're inclined to think of habits of thought and habits of behavior. And if we're, you know, sort of inclined towards, say, virtue ethics or even just, you know, trying to make ourselves more productive with life hacks or something like that, we do understand the force of habit for changing not just what we do, but also our mindsets. What is habit or custom for Hume? He tells us that it's a propensity. What is the propensity? A propensity, by the way, is a tendency, a disposition to doing something, to having something go a certain way. The book has a propensity to fall if I drop it. I have a propensity, if you've watched many of my videos, to wear a tie and a button-down shirt when I'm shooting them. Doesn't mean in every single case that I do that, of course, although the book will, in fact, if there's nothing blocking it, fall pretty every time, we think, right? So this propensity, he says, to renew the same act or operation without being impelled to by any reasoning or process of the understanding. So we're not thinking it through. It's not something cognitive in the sense of discursive where we lay it out and we're like, okay, so this should happen, this should happen, this should happen. No, the same act or operation happens. And he says, we always say that this propensity is the effect of custom. Now, custom in the time that Hume is talking about this covers a lot of ground. It can be the individual and what they're accustomed to. It can also talk about sort of the pressure of social forces and viewpoints on things that go without being questioned. It was viewed as important to not get rid of customs unless you have good reasons for that. You know, I'll give you a prime example of something that would be a custom. When a whole bunch of people are going to be doing something and they have to be processed individually, what do they typically do? Do they mob around and just kind of jump in there every once in a while? Sometimes, but usually we form an orderly line, right? That's a custom. That doesn't have to be the case. And there's probably different ways of doing it. Calling it forming a line is one way of talking about it. That's my custom. Forming a queue would be how British people would say it. And standing online is the way people describe it on the East Coast. Whereas if you say standing online here, people are going to look at in the Midwest. People will look at you like you're nuts. Those are all matters of custom. So he goes on and he says, in employing this word, we don't pretend to have given the ultimate reason of such a propensity. We're just pointing out a principle of human nature, universally acknowledged, well known by its effects. Everyone's going to grant that this takes place. Do we know why it takes place? No. And he says, it's sufficient. We can rest contented with it as the ultimate principle, which we can assign all our conclusions from experience. But it's not really an ultimate principle. We're not at the very bottom of it. We don't know exactly how it works. And that might be something that psychologists get into. And indeed, following from David Hume, psychologists devote a lot of attention to that question. But he's not worried about it. He's interested in what we can say about it from our ordinary experience. So how does it work? He tells us that a constant conjunction of two objects leads us to expect them in a certain order. So we see fire constantly conjoined with smoke. We assume when we see smoke that there, which is the effect, that there must be the cause governing it. When we see fire, we think, well, there's probably going to be some smoke coming from that. As a matter of fact, we don't say probably, we say there will be. And then if we're, you know, called on it, we might say, well, in certain circumstances, maybe there won't be, but probably, right? Or solidity and, how does he put it? Solidity and weight, right? Things that are solid objects, we expect them to weigh something. If they don't weigh anything, we're really surprised. Why? Because we've associated those two things together. In that case, what is the cause of what? I think we would say that the solidity is the cause of the weight, right? Although from a physical perspective, maybe we'd say the mass is the cause of the solidity. Mass and weight not being exactly the same thing, of course. But you see how this works. And he brings up examples of passions as well. A little bit later on, he tells us about hatred, for example. Yeah, here we go. It's unavoidable to feel the passion of love when we receive benefits or hatred when we meet with injuries, right? We sort of come to see somebody injures somebody else. They feel the passion of hatred. Or we ourselves are injured by somebody else or something else, and we feel hatred towards it, right? We feel good stuff coming. We associate that with love. And so this is a matter of constant conjunction. How constant does the conjunction have to be? It doesn't have to be completely perfect. As a matter of fact, the next section after this is called On Probability, but we do want there to be a fairly regular connection, right? So he tells us that custom ends up being, as he calls it, the great guide to human life. Isn't that an interesting idea there? He tells us that we expect the future to act like the past. He says, it's that principle alone which renders our experience useful to us and makes us expect for the future a similar train of effects with those that have appeared in the past. And so we can see in this discussion that it's not just about classes of objects or passions or whatever else they are that are connected with each other. There is an overarching, we might say, capital C principle of custom that tells us that when we observe similar effects or connections in the past, we can expect to see similar things in the future. So you could call it like a meta custom if you want to. And we rely on this to make our world coherent. This is what he says allows us to go beyond the resources that are provided to us by either memory of past experiences or what we're directly experiencing now through the senses. Otherwise, we would be stuck with what is immediately present to those. He says, we would never know how to adjust means to ends or employ our natural powers in the production of any effect. There would be an end all at once to all action as well as of the chief part of speculation. So in order to be able to function within a world, any sort of environment, to be able to use ourselves to do things, we need this principle of custom or habit, which then takes memory, senses, also what it gets from reasoning, perhaps what it also gets from culture. You know, it doesn't mean that it's infallible in associating these things. And it connects them together and gives us an output of expect this thing to happen. So he goes on and he tells us something else that's quite important. He says that we do this, we go beyond experience to infer all sorts of things from distant places and most remote ages, again, providing us with a world. And so we do these associations. And he closes this section by saying, what then is the conclusion of the whole matter? A simple one, though it must be confessed, pretty remote from the common theories of philosophy. So he's saying this is something quite different than what other philosophers are putting out there. My view on causality is that it really boils down to the way this custom works. And he says, belief of matters of fact, that is of empirical things in the world or real existence, whether something is or isn't, derives from several different things working together. We need to have some sort of object present to memory or the senses. And then we combine that with this principle of custom. custom, he says, customary conjunction. When we actually have that, then we can get these connections, flame and heat, snow and cold. If flame or snow be presented anew to the senses, the mind is carried by custom to expect heat or cold and to believe that such a quality does exist and will discover itself on a nearer approach. And he says, this belief is the necessary result of placing the mind in such circumstances. So without experience to draw upon, no custom or habit, it's sort of like a latent property within us, and presumably within other animals as well, drawing conclusions like that. Perhaps even it could be something, if we're thinking about machine learning, which is a rather metaphorical concept, there's something kind of like that going on in that as well, although that's going far beyond what Hume talks about. So this winds up being an incredibly important principle needed for anything that has to do with our connection with ourselves and the world. Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/Sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.